To you. It's a city as proud of its invention of the Big Mac and ketchup as it is of its rich cultural heritage. Pittsburgh, home to some of the great names of American industry, such as Carnegie, Heinz, and Frick, as well as to one of America's top orchestras, the Pittsburgh Symphony. Tonight, they are here with music director Manfred Honeck, music by Tchaikovsky, by Beethoven, and to open, Walter Braunfels, a late Romantic composer who for many years fell out of fashion. We'll be hearing extracts from his fantastic appearances of a theme of Hector Berlioz. Well, joining me throughout the evening is a man who certainly knows this orchestra very well indeed. He has been on 18 world tours with them. He is Jim Cunningham. Very warm welcome to the Proms, Jim.
Thrilled to be with you, Susie. What a treat to be here once more.
Now, it's not your first visit to the Proms. I know you've been making broadcasts with the Symphony Orchestra for how many years now?
32 years.
32 years. You deserve a badge for that. Do you remember your first Proms visit?
With Lorin Maazel, and it was amazing because he had as an encore the American in Paris, which was quite long, and I think it made your producer a little balmy to program a 17-minute encore, but it was absolutely thrilling.
Great. Well, we will talk more later in the concert, Jim. Thanks very much indeed. So here he comes, music director of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. It's Manfred Honeck to open the first of two proms from this orchestra.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, led tonight by concertmaster Tomo Keller, conducted by Manfred Honeck, opening the first of their two proms in this season with that shortened version of Walter Bronfels' fantastic appearances of a theme of Hector Berlioz. Just a taster there of a composer whom Manfred Honeck certainly really champions. Worth saying that the composer's grandson, Stefan Bronfels, is right here in the audience tonight. He's a very well-known architect in his own right. He lives and works in Berlin. He's also a close friend of tonight's conductor. And apparently Stefan tries to come to as many performances as he can of his grandfather's music. Well, next this evening, we've one of the most profoundly beautiful and certainly visionary piano concertos ever written, Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. Tonight's soloist is famed for her searching intensity, her thoughtfulness, and her love of Beethoven's music. She's the French pianist Hélène Grimaud, and I caught up with her earlier. I began by asking her how she tackled the famously difficult opening of this piece with the solo piano playing alone.
You start with honesty. I mean, I think it's paramount to any interpretation, so you don't try to be different just for the sake of being different. You try and do what you feel, and that's usually enough. You know, I think human beings, individuals, are original enough that that pretty much does it. If you put 100% of what you have into the interpretation, then hopefully something interesting comes across. And of course, this concerto, certainly that was one big departure from the classical format of the concerto previously, with this opening by the solo instrument, and it's one of the most difficult pieces. It's possibly the most difficult concerto only because of that opening.
Let's unpick this opening, because you are there, you're so exposed and vulnerable as a soloist, and you have to sort of set the agenda there. And how do you escape that sense of influence of all the recordings, of all the different people you've heard, and say, right, I'm going to take a moment and breathe? What do you do to get into that space you need to?
It has to sound, I can only find the French word, juste, meaning that everything has to be in its place. It has to be totally organic, incredibly expressive, but at the same time contained. I mean, it's one of these phrases, you could do it 1,000 times and you would still be trying. It's a very humbling experience, as a matter of fact, to be starting. It's just something very difficult to describe. The sound has to be just so, the phrasing has to be just so. It's frightening, really.
So once you're through those opening few seconds even, does that mean, okay, now you're on the trajectory and you can go for it once you've got through that initial barrier?
It's a good question, but actually, no, you're on the trajectory before. You should be, because that's it. It starts before the first note already. You can't have two beginnings.
Then we get the second movement, which again is extraordinary, where the piano is so plangent and there against this kind of ridiculously overblown, almost violent orchestra. How do you approach that music?
That's actually easier because you're already in a dialogue from the very beginning, and you come in already in the role of the one who brings contrast. Of course, that contrast has to be tremendous, as big as possible, but not necessarily, I mean, of course, in dynamic, but actually it says espressivo, and it doesn't even really give a very clear dynamic. I mean, even in the piano, this espressivo means it has to be focused, it has to be sustained, you know, it's not something of a whisper. It's way too much poignant to only be something which you do sort of discreetly as an echo of something. So, of course, that's, I would say, the difficulty, and then the phrase can never be long enough. And on an instrument that doesn't naturally sustain, such as the piano, it's of course always a battle to make that line sing.
A battle, though, that we suspect she probably will win, the totally charming Hélène Grimaud, who I met up with earlier today. Jim Cunningham, Hélène Grimaud and Manfred Honeck have worked together before, haven't they? And she's a very engaged, very serious person about the way that she likes to rehearse and the way she likes to work long-term with people.
We enjoyed her in Pittsburgh last season. She played the Beethoven Concerto there, and just a few days ago at the Grafenegg Festival in Austria, they loved her at Grafenegg. And I noticed you used the word on your poster outside, charismatic. She was recently part of a big article in the New York Times about the idea of charisma in music, and she was mentioned as one of the artists there who had that special quality.
Well, tell me a bit about the kind of intensity of this tour, because it does seem terribly glamorous, of course, travelling around as you do. I think you said this is your 18th tour, but there must be a certain amount of kind of logistical nightmare about it, the visas, the idea of travelling with this many people. Is it as glamorous as it sounds? Be honest.
For me, I love every minute of it. I have to pinch myself to be here in the Royal Albert Hall. For the orchestra, it can be very tiring. They just flew in this morning from last night in Lucerne, so the rooms weren't ready when they got to the hotel, and it's very, very tight, the schedule.
Well, at least you get to listen to some nice music.
No question about it. They're thrilled to be here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Great. We'll talk more later, Jim. Thank you. So, applause now for tonight's soloist and conductor, Hélène Grimaud, followed on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall by Manfred Honeck, to join the players of the Pittsburgh Symphony in Beethoven's 4th Piano Concerto. Music that baffled the first audiences and critics who heard it. It's Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4, performed live at the Proms by the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra and the music director Manfred Honeck. The soloist tonight, Hélène Grumeau. Well, this orchestra are back here tomorrow night for the second prom of this season from them. Then on Wednesday, they meet up again with Hélène Grumeau. That's in Paris at the Salle Pleyel. Saturday, they're all getting together in Bonn with several other dates in between. So just, you know, a usual laid-back week for these players. Warm smiles from Hélène Grumeau to the players of this orchestra as she returns to the stage. You can see why there's a great sympathy in a way between her and tonight's conductor, Manfred Honeck. A very contained quality in some ways to both of these players. They're not flashy musicians. Honeck, during those cadenzas there, was in such quiet, thoughtful reverie. There seems to be a real sympathy and understanding between these two, Jim Cunningham. You've seen them perform together before.
We love working together, and it shows, there's no question about it. Sometimes Hélène Grumeau can be, a little prickly, and she's canceled some concerts when the collaboration was not exactly right, but she and Manfred Honeck get along famously, both in Pittsburgh and here at the Royal Albert Hall tonight.
And also it seems to be they're both musicians who take such meticulous pains to get every detail right. They both have their ears so finely tuned to this music, and it's imperative that they get Beethoven just right.
No question about it. Manfred uses every moment of rehearsal right till the very last moment of the clock, and he loves to work on the details and get everything precisely the way Hélène Grumeau and Manfred would like to have it.
Well, I know you were saying earlier that it's a bit of an itinerary and there's a tiny bit of jet lag possibly going on. You can't really hear it in these players. They look terribly feisty tonight.
There's no doubt about it. They've been looking forward to this concert all along the way, and I think everybody tried to get a good nap this afternoon, even though they got into their hotel room a little bit late and took the better part of the day to arrive here.
Well, much tapping of bows on music stands and a general applause from all the players for tonight's soloist, Hélène Grumeau, as well as warm applause from a full Royal Albert Hall. So, time now for an interval, around 25 minutes or so still to come here at the Royal Albert Hall this evening. The Pittsburgh Symphony and Manfred Honeck bring us music by Tchaikovsky, his fifth symphony. Now, though, it's time for our interval feature, and this week sees the 10th anniversary of 9/11. In tonight's essay, the broadcaster and writer Michael Goldfarb vividly recalls where he was the day that terrorist planes flew into the Twin Towers in New York.
10 years on. Time to dust off the old "where were you when you heard the news" question. By chance, I was in Boston, preparing to present a radio interview and call-in program. Hi, Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. America's under attack this morning. A series of bombs along the East Coast has led to the destruction of the World Trade Center and an attack on the Pentagon. The first attack came shortly before 9 a.m. this morning, the height of the morning rush hour in downtown New York. Two planes slammed into each of the towers of the World Trade Center. About a half an hour after those events, President Bush came out and made this statement.
We've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
This was not what the day was supposed to hold. The Connection was an interview call-in program, 1 hour on the news, 1 hour on culture. The previous day, I had spent the second hour talking to Salman Rushdie. It was that kind of show. On the morning of 9/11, I was gearing up for another big beast, Jack Welch, head of General Electric, the world's largest corporation. While I was figuring out how I was going to take him to task for commercializing TV news, GE owned NBC, the station's news director came to the Connection cubicle and urged us to come look at the pictures from New York. A plane had hit the World Trade Center. Maybe we should change the show. I asked sarcastically, "Are we going to do an hour on aviation accidents?" Not more than 10 seconds after we got to the newsroom, the second plane hit. Live, as we watched, I cursed. "It's Osama," I said loudly, saying a name I instantly knew I could not say on air that day. What do you do when one era ends and another begins, as you watch it on TV? How do you go on the air and broadcast it on radio? Keep it calm, descriptive, and as my colleague Bob Oak says, stick to the facts, such as they are.
What we do know is that at least two planes crashed into the buildings, one each. You could see dramatic footage in slow motion of the second plane crashing into the second tower, actually intentionally turning into it, and later another explosion at the Pentagon.
Bob, I need to interrupt you for just a second. It's just been confirmed to me that one of the planes that crashed into the World Trade Center was American Airlines Flight 11 from Boston to Los Angeles. I'm looking at the pictures. I continue to be amazed at the pall of smoke drifting out over New York Harbor. The picture calls to mind to me the famous photograph of St. Paul's Cathedral rising above the smoke and debris of the Blitz. All of Lower Manhattan seems to be covered in this smoke, and the surviving World Trade Tower looks like an enormous manufacturing chimney gaping smoke.
You embrace the chaos. Knowledgeable guests arrive, are brought into the studio. No time for introductions. You fumble over their names. Your headset is full of contradictory chatter and instructions from the program's producer and studio director. You hear, but don't really listen, to the answers your experts give to your questions. When you hear a second and a half of silence in the studio, you turn to the other guest, say their name, hopefully correctly, with a slight rise on the last syllable so they know it's their turn to speak. Repetition is everything. Assume that people are just tuning in and still haven't quite figured what the hell is going on. Try and summarize correctly, even when the director or producer is feeding you new information while you're speaking.
Just to recapitulate again, the timeline is now becoming clear. The events are unfolding so quickly. The first plane crashed into a tower of the World Trade Center shortly before 9 a.m. this morning. Second plane just after 9 a.m. President Bush spoke, called the crashes apparent terrorist attacks and a national tragedy. Shortly thereafter, an aircraft crashed into the Pentagon just outside of Washington. And I've just been informed that a car bomb is reported to have exploded just outside the State Department. This is after reports of a bomb going off at the Capitol building.
Of course, no car bomb had gone off at the State Department, nor had there been one at the Capitol. The chaos we were experiencing in our radio studio had claimed the wire services, AP and Reuters, as well as television news. We were sucked into a feedback loop of rumor. We tried to keep things fact-based, not speculate, but really the only facts were the ones you could see with your own eyes. And the sight of the remaining tower burning, Lower Manhattan and New York Harbor covered with a pall of ash and smoke, specific as the image was, could only raise more questions. Who did it? Can't ask that. Can't rush to judgment, even though anyone with a modicum of knowledge knew this was the work of Al-Qaeda. But how might it have been planned? That you could ask. My guests were terrorism experts at the nexus of elite education and the security services. Surely they might have an idea, but events overtook even the most perceptive comments.
We do know this is an extremely sophisticated group, presumably with a membership that can be drawn upon at need, perhaps even a group with sleepers in the United States or individuals that were brought in. It is hard to speculate.
It is hard to speculate, but I mean, could you talk a bit about the kinds of skills that terrorist groups actually have? Oh, my. As I watch, we do have a television in the studio. The second tower of the World Trade Center has just collapsed.
Oh, God.
The skyline of Lower Manhattan is irrevocably altered. A plume of smoke. My guests and I can only tell you, listeners, are shocked. The tower has come down. The World Trade Center's twin towers no longer exist.
Now the chaos becomes a roar in the head. Ask questions. Conduct the conversation. But the words of my mouth were not the meditations of my heart or my memory. Although I have lived most of my adult life in London, I'm a native New Yorker. I watched those buildings rise on the southern horizon of my youth. An image kept coming back while asking questions, a memory. A cold, clear winter night, sometime in the late 1960s, when the towers were under construction. Crossing Lower Fifth Avenue near Washington Square Park and noticing the building's steel frame covered in red and white lights. For the first time, the towers were now higher in the sky than the Grand Arch in the middle of Washington Square. Year in, year out, this was the spot where I monitored their progress. I knew them from the inside. In the late 70s, during my acting days, when part-time jobs and the dole were my real source of income, I had spent a couple of weeks working as a file clerk in an office on the 92nd floor of one of the towers. Watching them come down, I remembered the morning rush from the subway to the lift. You had to change lifts somewhere around the 50th floor to get to the upper levels. There was always a massive crush of people around 8:45, trying to get to their desks by 9. Some mornings, it took longer to get from the subway to the office, 90-plus floors above me, than it did to get to the World Trade Center from my flat on 15th Street, several miles away. How many thousands of people were in the middle of that vertical commute when the planes hit? How many hundreds of thousands were scurrying around the windswept plaza to other office buildings? As TV cameras showed a never-ending swirl of dust and smoke billowing around Lower Manhattan, I thought of how you could look down on the clouds from the window of that 92nd floor office, as if you were in an airplane sailing above bad weather. And on a clear day, in the late afternoon, you could follow the twin shadows the buildings cast, a long diagonal cutting across Manhattan, the East River, and Queens, to Long Island Sound, all the way to Connecticut. Over. Done. Ask a question, go to the phones, listen to more instructions, try to watch the clock, relay more rumors, temporarily holding the classification of fact. Do not mention casualty counts. They're always off, but it's not possible to think that it will be less than many, many thousands. When the show was over, the post-mortem was fairly brief. The event was still going on. It would go on for days. We knew that the program would have to deal with this catastrophe till the end of the week. With the combined faculties of Harvard, MIT, Tufts, and Boston University on hand, and with most of them stuck in town, we knew there would be no shortage of experts to call on to come in and talk about this event from any angle you could think of. But there was one radiophonic dilemma to sort out. The music. You don't think of it. The music on speech radio is part of the background sound picture, and it can disappear without trace or comment. In public radio, in the U.S., however, music is an essential part of programming rhythm. It's used as a nonverbal endpoint to segments in the news programs, a way of pointing the listener to a change of subject, a metaphorical breathing space. The Connection had a very distinctive theme song, Herbie Hancock's Cantaloupe Island. As you can hear, it swings, it's breezy, but has some edge. And we knew it was totally inappropriate. We huddled to decide what to play in its place. I was deputized to think of something that would work. 10 years later, I'm still thinking. What music is appropriate to mark an unprecedented national catastrophe? Unprecedented in its nature, its scope, and unprecedented for having been experienced in real time through the verisimilitude of broadcast images and sound. The abstract language of music, with its direct connection to our emotional core, is the only form of expression human beings possess to deal with such an extreme event. But the combination of feelings that swirled around us that day were hard to imagine being reconciled in a single sting of music. Grief, rage, fear, dread were the foremost emotions being felt across the country that day, and they had to be balanced against a musical sound that expressed America. And that has always been a more hopeful sound. I had an idea straight away. A piano piece, the Prelude in E-flat minor by Dmitri Shostakovich, as played by Sviatoslav Richter. Perversely, this has always been a favorite piece, calling to my mind a sense of standing alone against fate, bleeding, battered, and resolute. That was the image that came to mind for my city and country, whose sense of itself had been undone in the space of a few hours. Later, I would find out that more than 200 years ago, the German writer Christian Schubert had tried to classify in words the emotions each musical key create in a listener. Of E-flat minor, or D-sharp minor, depending on how the composer chooses to write the key signature, he wrote, "Feelings of the anxiety of the soul's deepest distress, of brooding despair, of blackest depression, of the most gloomy condition of the soul. If ghosts could speak, their speech would approximate this key." No surprise that it's a key used mostly by Russian composers, and in the end, that's why I didn't suggest the piece. It sounded too Russian, not American enough. What is the American sound? The country is too big and the culture is too complex. There isn't just one. Jazz enthusiasts claim their music is America's indigenous classical music. They have a case, but a key element of jazz is swing, as I said, and that was inappropriate to the day. And jazz signifies urban. Miles Davis was appropriate for New York, but not the rest of the country, so jazz was out. Same with the blues, music created out of the pain of hundreds of years of slavery and segregation, a major part of American history, but this was a new event, not connected to that bleak note in our national story. No, it would have to be something orchestral. I cursed Oliver Stone for turning Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings into a national cliché when he used it in Platoon, and clichés wouldn't do to mark this occasion. By general agreement, the closest any composer has come to summarizing the nation in orchestral music is Aaron Copland. And I started running music cues from his Third Symphony in my memory, looking for things that might work. The bruised sound of violins and woodwinds at the start of the Third Symphony with the almost, "they're there, it'll be all right" response from the brass. Hint at quiet strength being recovered after some terrible struggle. The symphony was composed immediately after the Second World War. Its four movements, a summary of those years, beginning with the theme of quiet resolve, which develops a few minutes later into a passage of genuine rage. The music signifies the American Colossus roused. And on that day, 10 years ago, the roar in my head, the memories of the World Trade Center rising up, the work of years, its destruction, the work of an hour, the bodies atomized in that toxic pall of smoke. But the music is too intense, and not possible to turn into a 30-second or 45-second loop of sound that a presenter can read a bit of script over. Something calmer, quieter was needed. The incidental music for Quiet City. Copland wrote the music for a play that failed and then reworked the score. The orchestra sounds like sunrise through a mist before a trumpet solo takes over. This might have worked, that last post feel. But as always in Copland, the hope shines through. I think that's why he's considered the American composer. The hope that dominates his sound, hope, tomorrow will be better, has always been the secret of why my native country has survived traumas that would have destroyed other societies. I didn't suggest Quiet City. Hope didn't seem right that day. It was about anger. Back in my hotel room, I did a phone interview with the World Service about the day's events and surprised myself with how angry I was. I told the interviewer, "This changes everything." I meant the U.S. would go it alone in its pursuit of the perpetrators. Multilateral approaches were finished. America would send out a posse to find Osama, and the international community could go hang if it wanted the niceties of process at the U.N. What I didn't mean, what I didn't know, is that hope, as expressed in so much of Copland's music, was what had changed that day. It was gone. These last 10 years, characterized by profligacy, wars that failed, spending trillions of borrowed money, bespeaks an attitude of living for today because tomorrow we may all be dead. Anyway, I couldn't think of any music that was appropriate. Silence was the best I could come up with. A decade on from 9/11, I'm certain I was right. Silence, in such circumstances, is the most eloquent music.
Tonight's essay was presented by the broadcaster and writer Michael Goldfarb. It was produced by Julia Habel and was a Wise Buddha production for BBC Radio 3. A very warm welcome back from me, Susie Klein. You're listening to The Proms live on Radio 3, where tonight we've the first of two concerts from the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. Just one piece left on the bill this evening. It's one of the most popular symphonies in the repertoire. It is Tchaikovsky's Fifth, a classic journey from darkness into blazing light. It has all the typical ingredients of Tchaikovsky: a heart-on-sleeve directness, dark foreboding, and sweet lyricism. Listening with me this evening is Jim Cunningham. Pleasure to have you with me, Jim.
It's wonderful.
You follow this orchestra around, you broadcast many of their concerts, you have a weekly breakfast show that I know you do on radio. Tell me something about the relationship of this orchestra with this conductor. What has Manfred Honeck brought to Pittsburgh?
Well, one of our cellists, Hampton Mallory, when Manfred first began performing with the orchestra, said there's just something about him. It's hard to put your finger on exactly what it is, but it's a warmth of a feeling, a genuineness. He's all about music. No flash, no artificial trappings of the maestro, the music director. It's all centered on the music. And I remember our principal trumpet, George Vosburgh, who you heard right away in the Braunfels this evening. When Manfred came and conducted one of his first concerts, he said, this guy knows exactly what he wants, and he knows how to ask for it. And I thought, isn't that something that you would expect from every conductor? But in this case, it's a very special thing. And Tchaikovsky Fifth was one of the first pieces that he chose when he was just beginning a relationship with the orchestra, before he'd been named music director. So it's very special. They recorded it in 2008. It's just been released on the Exton label. So Tchaikovsky 5, very important for Manfred and the orchestra. And of course, they played it with every music director all along the way. They recorded it with William Steinberg many years ago. I remember Maurice Janssens took it on tour. They did it in the Teatro Colón in Buenos Aires with great success. And here at the Proms, too, I believe, Tchaikovsky with Maurice Janssens was always special, not to mention Lauren Mazel, our music directors. So Tchaikovsky 5, really, for every orchestra, important, but a big piece of the history of the Pittsburgh Symphony.
And what kind of demands does Honeck make on these musicians in terms of what he wants this Tchaikovsky to feel like?
Well, you heard that super slow playing, that wonderful quiet playing in the Beethoven in the first half. Quiet playing is what's so extraordinary. Listening to the Andante, I don't think I've ever heard it played so quietly. And the horn solo from our principal horn, William Caballero, very, very special. The clarinet, our principal clarinet, Michael Rusnik, a little wisp of sound coming from the Andante. I think you will find it extraordinary.
Jim, thank you very much indeed. So the players of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra in place on stage now, led tonight by Tone O'Keller and conducted by their music director, Manfred Honeck, here for a performance of Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony.
Thank you.
from that ancient smoky darkness to a blaze of triumph and light. The music of Tchaikovsky, his Symphony No. 5 in E minor, formed at the Proms by the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra under Manfred Honeck, their concertmaster Tomo Keller. Well, this orchestra, founded 1895, it can claim one of the longest standing traditions of any American orchestra. Its rise to the real top ranks happening during the 1930s under Otto Klemperer and Fritz Reiner. Since then, music directors have included Andre Previn, Lauren Marzell, Maris Janssens. Manfred Honeck is their ninth music director. He joined this orchestra in their 2008-09 season. Applause there for William Caballero, principal horn. And all the brass players getting to their feet. Jim Cunningham, you do get an incredible sense of warmth and response between these players and this conductor. It's so obvious that they hugely love working with them.
There's tremendous respect. Remember, Manfred was a member of the Vienna Philharmonic for 10 years, playing the violin and the viola. His brother Reiner is still a member of the Vienna Philharmonic as one of their concertmasters. His sister Zibella is a member of the Vienna Symphony Orchestra. His whole family is musical. His wife Christiana is a violinist. They met at a youth orchestra. And you can hear the results of that chemistry with the Pittsburgh Symphony and Manfred Honeck. Great respect between the orchestra and their new music director.
Yes, he absolutely conducts like a musician. I mean, half the time you can see him bowing as if he's playing the violin on stage, but very focused, very concentrated movement from him, but incredible understanding of the score. And he gets these players to really give it their all.
And it's wonderful to have some new musicians on the stage. Lorna McGee is from Scotland. She was your co-principal flute in the BBC Orchestra some years ago.
Yes,
then she went
the BBC
to Canada.
Symphony Orchestra. I think she played till 1998. She was a member of that orchestra.
She's just joined us. Ed Stefan is just with the orchestra these last 3 weeks. We hired him from the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, our new principal timpanist.
So you're basically going around the world poaching the best players for your orchestra. That's the plan.
They were hired because they know what to do, no question about it. And they wanted to work with Manfred Honeck. They're thrilled to be part of the orchestra.
Jim, in the 32 years that you've been working with this band, listening to these players, are there any surprises ever for you?
Oh, so many. I mean, you mentioned the music directors, Andre Previn, who we absolutely loved and produced national television programs, just like the BBC Music Night programs he did here in London. They've all been amazing. Leonard Bernstein came back in 1984 to recall the Jeremiah Symphony that he'd done the world premiere of during the war years. One after the other, great, great nights of music making. Klaus Tennstedt was a famous guest we had, but best of all of the music directors like Manfred Honeck.
Thank you.
the prelude from Bizet's Carmen, featuring the playing of Lorna McGee. We were just speaking about her a moment ago. Used to be co-principal flute in the BBC Symphony Orchestra. She's one of the more recent additions to the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. Now, Jim, I know you're not the only person from Pittsburgh here tonight. There are some orchestral groupies, aren't there?
There certainly are. Of course, there are some wives and friends of the musicians and students who've joined them here in London. But we have the chairman of the board, Richard Simmons, who donated some $20 million of his personal fortune to the orchestra. He's brought along friends, and they're all enjoying up in the choir loft tonight.
And they're all off to Paris and Bonn to have a great time. So lovely to have had all of you here in town. And the players of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra with music director Manfred Honeck, all on their feet. And they want him back for more. There's a lot of stamping going on in here. Well, we've had one encore this evening. Where will we get two? Let's see if Manfred Honeck decides to return. He does.
You know, Susie, it's wonderful to see them all against the rail here, against the red velvet.
Well, applause there for Michael Rusinek's cheeky little improvisation there, his little cadenza based, I think, on the Beatles, When I'm 64. That was Kachaturian's Gallop from his incidental music for Masquerade, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, conducted here at the Proms by Manfred Honeck. Well, that's it for this evening, but they are back here tomorrow to do it all over again. The Pittsburgh Symphony and Manfred Honeck, joined tomorrow by the violinist and Sophie Mutter for Wolfgang Riem's concerto, the Gesungenes Zeit. They'll also be performing the prelude to Wagner's Lohengrin and music by Mahler, his fifth symphony. Do join me for that. That's tomorrow from 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3. But for now, time to thank my guest, Jim Cunningham, and to bid you good night, handing you back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Susie.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Susie. Susie Klein there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to add, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom again here on BBC Radio 3 on Thursday afternoon, this Thursday afternoon at 2:30.
It's the last but one night of the BBC Proms. And for 2011, a chance to celebrate the extraordinary musicianship of Sir John Eliot Gardner. Hot Foot from the Opéra Comique in Paris, Berlioz's rarely heard revamp of Weber's Der Freischütz can be heard live on BBC Radio 3 this Friday night. Join me, Martin Handley, for this very famous overture and everything that goes after it. Friday night from 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, as Susie Klein said just a minute or two ago, Mahler's Fifth Symphony from the Pittsburgh Orchestra in tomorrow night's Prom. And right now, a little bit of Prom's Mahler history. This is the fourth movement, Urlicht, from Mahler's Resurrection Symphony. As for the performance, it was the first ever performance of Mahler's Resurrection Symphony at the Proms. The date is the 30th of July, 1963. Leopold Stokowski is conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. And the singer you can hear later on tonight here on Radio 3 talking to Norman Lebrecht, Janet Baker.
Thank you.
Mahlerlicht, Primeval Lights, from the first ever performance of Mahler's Second Symphony at the Proms. Leopold Stokowski conducting the LSO in July 1963 with the singer, a young Janet Baker. And you can hear Dame Janet talking to Norman Lebrecht in the Lebrecht interview at 10:15 this evening, quarter of an hour's time from now. So a little more of Janet Baker in the meantime. This is from a recital she gave with Raymond Lepard at the 1971 Aldborough Festival, a programme that ranged from Monteverdi to Fauré and Gounod via Schubert, and not the usual Schubert songs either. Three altogether, ranging from the comic to the near-tragic. The second is a short aria from a Goethe Singspiel, Schubert either never completed or some of which just got lost. Then an die untergehende Sonne, sunset seen as almost divine intervention. First, though, Schwestergruß, a dead sister's spirit, sends a greeting from heaven. Thank you. Isn't that wonderful, Schubert singing? The singer Janet Baker with Raymond Lepard at the 1971 Aldborough Festival, Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears sitting in the audience, and three Schubert songs, opening with Schwestergruß and ending there with An die untergehende Sonne. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10:15. And now here's Norman Lebrecht with the last in this summer series of the Lebrecht interview.
Dame Janet Baker is the most successful English opera singer of modern times. Yorkshire-born, she worked in a bank until her parents approved a move to London, where she studied privately with Helena Isep and Meriel St. Clair. A production of Handel's Rodelinda, in which she sang Edwige, introduced her to the Baroque. Major roles at Glyndebourne and Covent Garden, followed by recordings with Raymond Lepard, John Barbirolli and Bernard Haitink, made her a world star. For 20 years, there was a Janet Baker benchmark for vocal consistency. She was a big singer who never sang below her own high standard. She's also, in part, a contradiction in terms. For as well as being a pioneer of the Handel revival and of new works by Benjamin Britten, she was the last genuine English contralto, a type of voice that extends back into the mists of musical time. Dame Janet retired from opera before she was 50, and from concerts 7 years later. Fastidious, self-assured, and private in a distinctly old-fashioned way, Janet Baker managed to avoid the taints of fame and experience only the glories. We meet midsummer in a London studio. Janet Baker, do you ever wake up in the morning, 20 years on, with that pit of the stomach feeling, thinking, I've got a performance tonight?
That's one of the joys of being retired, actually, that one doesn't wake up like that. It's a hard one to deal with, and we all deal with it in our own various ways, but it is like, in a sense, a shadow over one's life, that pit of the stomach fear. You have to deal with fear all the time in various degrees. And I found that I never conquered it completely.
So you always got up in the morning with gritted teeth?
Well, the pit of the stomach, the turnover, you know, mm-hmm. and the way performing days inflicted a pattern on one's life that was relentless and also had to be obeyed. You had to be, I suppose, we were like athletes. We are like athletes, singers are. You have to be very fit and very strong in every sense of the word to cope with the not only the actual performing, but the stress of what goes on around it.
And you talked often of that dedication, of that responsibility to serve the composer, to be at your best, not to let the side down. That was a burden that you carried every waking moment.
Yes, it was a burden in a sense, because you felt responsible to the notes on the page and the words on the page. That never left you. And also responsibilities to one's colleagues. I used to try not to show my own fear or my own worries to a cast when I was in a cast, because
you had to be the strong one.
Well, I felt that it was part of the job. If you were in a responsible role, then you had a duty to colleagues as well, to care for their needs as well. And it was something I liked very much. I loved working in a group like that. I wish, in retrospect, that I could have been more light-hearted about it, but it just wasn't my personality. It was a responsibility.
Where did that sense of responsibility come from? Was that your background? Was it your parents?
No, not really. I've talked to a lot of people about this in various spheres, and it seems to me that there's a feeling which stems right from childhood that something is going to happen. You don't quite know what it is, and you don't know how it'll be expressed. I certainly didn't, but I felt strongly that I was to do something special with my life. Perhaps we all feel this.
From what age?
Oh, 9 years old.
Was there a moment?
I think what kicked it off was being in the church choir and singing the usual hymns and the usual music that you get in a Church of England modest choir. And then we would suddenly have a setting by Bach. And as soon as we sang one of the great chorales, it would be in church, Everything seemed to come together for me at that, and I used to remember vividly, this is it, this is real music, this is the kind of music that I feel is authentic, so to speak. And it used to inspire me in a way that other music did not. The Wesleys, John Wesley, did not give me the same feeling as singing a Bach. It was that sense of listening to music on the radio as well and reacting to music on the radio, which my family didn't feel it seemed. It seemed
particular
to me the same
pieces.
Way.
I mean, did you tune into the Proms?
Yes, orchestral music. Proper music.
Proper music. And particular works that caught your ear. I'm 9 years old. You're in Pigtails and
that's right.
And short songs.
It had to be good. I seemed to recognise which was the best kind of music I wanted to listen to.
And you would shush the rest of the family
when
it came on the wireless?
No, not really, but I'd listen to it and they wouldn't.
You came from Yorkshire working stock. You had miners in the family.
Yes, indeed. All my uncles were miners. Not my father, he was an engineer. And I think my mother wanted to get my brother and I out of that environment to something else. So that is why I spent all my youth in York and went to school in York and feel as though that was my home.
Did your mother work?
She worked in the Observer Corps during the war. Mm. But apart from that, not. It wasn't all that usual in those days in the 40s for a woman of about 40. She was too old. She wouldn't have joined up, of course, because she couldn't. Mm. But she went into the Observer Corps and loved it. And all sorts of things happened during the war. My brother died during the war.
Yes.
But I feel very much bound to my Yorkshire roots, grassroots of the mining community and what used to happen to them and my aunts and uncles having a very tough time. You don't forget things like that. That's where I come from.
Mm. Mm. You were 10 when your brother died.
Yes, I was.
Sudden?
Again, in retrospect...
He was four years older than me.
Yes.
And your only brother?
Yes, he had heart trouble and was an invalid most of his life. So.
Right.
My parents were very bound up in his care.
Yes.
In retrospect, I feel I should have had more help when he died. People didn't talk about things in the same way they do now.
Did you know it was coming?
Only the day he died, my parents kept the seriousness of the matter away from me until the day he died. So I can remember those 24 hours as though it were yesterday, trying to come to terms in my 10-year-old mind with what was going on and what would happen.
How were you told?
I watched him die. And they said to me, this is not, Peter's not going to be with us longer than today. The doctors knew that he was sinking. And to try and take that in at 10, I couldn't. And then I had to try and understand what my parents were going through. You can imagine I can't imagine anything worse than losing a child. So my parents, there was that atmosphere in the house. And I wish now that I'd had somebody to talk to me, as of course you would certainly have these days. And I think perhaps part of the seriousness of my character stems from that knowledge and going into the teens with the family in sadness and in bereavement, which they never really came out of, understandably.
And you had no one with whom to share it?
Nobody talked to me about it. Very, very hard.
When a terrible trauma like that hits a family, there's usually one person who steps up and takes responsibility.
I didn't realise that.
And it sounds as though it may have been you.
Well, I think perhaps that's quite right. My mother was, they were both absolutely distraught. And I suppose I spent the rest of my life trying to make my parents happy, being responsible for their happiness. I was a very responsible daughter.
Was there also a sense of surrogacy that you had to be the person that your brother wasn't? You had to fill that gap? You had to achieve the things that he didn't?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I didn't feel that. I felt that this feeling we were talking about a moment ago of destiny, if one can put it like that, was my own territory, so to speak. It didn't interfere at all with the personal things going on around me, somehow apart, and always has been, actually. It's something that I've probably is a protection.
You won a scholarship to a grammar school at York Minster College, and then you promptly left.
Well, I didn't. It was a girls' a church school, a small girls' public school, and I think the influence, I was there for 2 or 3 years, and that influence on me was great, because the girls came from different backgrounds from me, and our teachers were exceptional. They were exceptional women, and I think had an influence on all of us. In fact, some of the girls I went to school with at that time, my best and oldest friend is from that, the same form that we were in, and we still see each other. And some of us meet from time to time, and even now as old women and grandparents, things like that, and discuss how much we owed those women. They were exceptional women who looked after us. So I was there for an important time. My father changed his job after the war, so I was taken away from that school. Fortunately, if you look back on life, I think mine has been so... It fits in like a jigsaw puzzle, one thing after the other. Well, that didn't seem right at the time, but by golly, now it does. And I went to a very academic school in Grimsby, which had a marvellous reputation not only for scholarship, but also for music. It was very, very active in the arts. And I started to explore music in a way that I wouldn't have done at the other school in the same way. Madrigal societies and singing of all sorts, quartets, church choir again. So I owe a debt to that school and to my companions there, who were terrific, very, very good friends. And although I found the school tough, there were things that came out of it which I now realise were marvellous.
Straight from school, you went to work in a bank.
Yes, I did.
What kind of work?
Well, it was a bank in York. We were moved back to York by then, and it was one of those old-fashioned banks which did the paperwork in pen and ink, you know. The cashiers were working in pen and ink, except for the fact that some of us were trained on the National Cash Register machines for posting statements and bank accounts and things. And I was like a fish out of water, but it was a good job and enabled me to do some studying in Leeds with a teacher there. Mm-hmm. And after...
Was it numbing? Was it boring?
No, it wasn't, because, again, the girls in where I worked with were so terrific. It was life in the real sense of the word. They thought I was a bit eccentric because of music, and I used to sing when I was tapping away at my natural catcher. I used to hum under my breath, I thought. However, my humming under my breath used to spread over the office, and the girls used to look at each other and she's off again, you know. But they were great companions. And the wonderful thing, again, the other piece of the jigsaw that came out of that was that at 20, when I wanted to study in London, I realised that I had to move down to the capital, was that they gave me a transfer in the full knowledge that they knew I was going to leave if I was at all lucky, and take it up full time. But I was honest enough to admit that that was what I was going to do. And my local director, I think he was pleased with the fact that I'd been honest with him. And at one point in the interview, when I said I wanted to go and live in London, he said, "And I suppose you'll be leaving us soon." I said, "Well, that is my aim." But he gave me the transfer, and it meant that my passage as a very raw northern girl was eased, because I lived in Bank Hostel with other girls for some months.
So you worked in the branch in London?
I worked in the branch in London.
And the bank provided accommodation?
Yes, they did.
And you had to be in at 10
That's
o'clock
right,
or
and
whatever?
I did. Yeah. And, oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I did full working days and then studied on top of that, which was quite hard. And I didn't last very long because it was so hard. What? I had a part-time job at Morley College to pay the rent. Dear old Morley College, who was the lifesaver of many people, and then studied.
What impact did London make on you?
Oh, well, enormous. In those days, it was of primary importance to come to the capital, because that was where it all is happening. I don't know if that still pertains. Probably it does. But in those days, there wasn't the opportunity or the kudos, in a sense, with the greatest respect to places like the Northern College, which was marvellous. London was the place I felt I wanted to be.
And you came into quite different circles. Helena Isep was a Viennese refugee. It introduced you not just to London, but to a whole continental world.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. The input, which was enormous and very fast, was very much influenced by the group of people she knew. And what I always feel we owe a debt, my generation owes such a debt to all those amazingly gifted refugees in all sorts of ways who came to England in the 1938 period and gave us a tremendous boost in the arts.
Who were the ones that you got
Paul
to know?
Hamburger, mm-hmm. Hans Keller, mm-hmm. All sorts
That's
of people.
That's just the BBC ones.
Well, yes, exactly.
So 3 years, you're working your way in London and you're earning bits and pieces of money, but really yes. just subsistence. And yes. then you have this terrible car accident.
Yes, I did. I was in the Glyndebourne Chorus at that time, and I was in London and had an argument with a London bus, which...
You were driving?
No, I wasn't. I was a pedestrian. It was long before I learned to drive, before I was married, just before I was married. I had just met my husband and had a concussion and a back problem, which I've had ever since. It's dogged my life, but... Apart from that, I was okay. It was just a shock, that's all. But I was already in the Glyndebourne Chorus then and started there, which was another wonderful piece of the jigsaw, which happened to work for me. Another learning curve, absolutely.
They actually offered you a solo role.
Well,
and you turned
I was
it down.
In the chorus. Mm. I was in the chorus for 2 years, mm-hmm. and they wanted to give me understudies. And I went back and said to my teacher, they want me to understudy this, and she was horrified. She said, I'd rather you didn't accept anything like that. While you're in this course, it's hard work enough. And I did as I was told, and I didn't accept any understudies. And then the next year when I got back, I think I did one or two. But she was right. And then, of course, I went back. Mm-hmm. Yes, I went back as a soloist. It was... Again, the way I was trained by her and by Mariel, but mostly technically by Helena, she gave me my technique. That technique was a foundation stone for the rest of my working life. It's quite something to find that in one person.
So this is your Annus Mirabilis. You join the Glyndebourne Chorus, you get knocked down by a bus, you're allowed to enter a competition in memory of Kathleen Ferrier,
yes.
despite missing the preliminary rounds because you're concussed. And you make the last five. Mm. Barbara Robinson
That's right.
won.
Yes.
What became of her? Did she make a career?
It's a very good question. I don't think she followed up her career. Great mistake, because it was a wonderful instrument.
Mm.
I don't think she had the fire in the belly that's necessary. Mm. A lot of other things are necessary besides a talent. And it's a pity, but she wanted a different kind of life. I suppose she came to terms with the fact that she really didn't want to be a performer. That happens, doesn't it?
Decisions.
Yes. And actually, coming second didn't seem to do me any harm, because a lot came of that. The publicity from the Daily Mail at that time.
The Daily Mail sponsored the competition.
Yes,
it was the first competition in memory of Ferrier, who died 3 years
That's
before.
Right.
So it was almost as though you were stepping into the shoes of a national institution.
Well, we're always quoted as stepping into somebody's shoes. I suppose somebody's quoted as stepping into mine, but it just doesn't exist. There's nobody who can step into anybody else's shoes. Thank God we're all completely unique people.
And then you had your first role, which is an Oxford University production of Smetana, The Secret.
Yes.
And you'd met this man on a tennis court.
My husband.
And
yes.
got engaged.
That's right. We got engaged in 56, we got married in 57. And, you know, as time went on, it became obvious that I needed his business sense, his businessman. And we were passing on the stairs. And, you know, this is no way to run one's life. I'm always away or doing something. And Emmy Tillett at that time, who was my agent, we said to her, what do we do about this? And she said, I can train Keith in this business. He's an excellent businessman and he can look after you personally as though he was a personal business manager. Nobody had this then, except in the pop world. And my colleagues often say, I wish Keith would manage me as well. Do you think he'd take anybody else on? Because they could see what a difference having that person who is absolutely for you, in connection with Emmy, of course, they worked in tandem together, but they organised my career. Keith organised my life in every possible way. And it, I'm sure that, in again, in retrospect, that support, in every sense of the word, made it possible for me to work at the pressure that I did for over 33 years. And we were together all the time, which is, and still are, you know, we're sort of joined at the hip. If I'm seen in the street by a neighbour, they all say, where's Keith? As though we're joined at the hip, which in many ways we are. But that was a something that came out of the fact that we were apart
you
so
much. You were missing
much.
Each other. And
yes.
Yeah,
and thought,
yeah,
this, ships this is in not the night. On, you know. Yeah, yeah. And made this very difficult decision at a time when it wasn't usual. It wasn't usual for a man to be working with a woman. Nowadays, all that sort of thing, men looking after children, men being house husbands, whatever, we take for granted. But in the 1950s, it was a very original thing to do.
I can't think of any other instance where an agent has trained someone to be a singer's husband.
There you are. She knew, she realised the way my career was going, and she was a very wise woman. But he's a very strong personality, and was not at all sidetracked by the fact, he always said, I've spent my life walking three steps behind you. In one way that is true, and in another way it is not, because he is his own man and always has been.
The decision not to have children, you took that very early on.
Yes.
You made that, it's career or children, it can't be both.
I think perhaps this might again, as you, when you get as old as I am, you think of your life in a different way, and things slot into a pattern. And although we did make that decision when we were very, very young, I think it might have been influenced by the fact that my mother had lost a child, and I could see what that did to her and my father. I'm sure this would have had an influence. But also the fact that I knew my sense of purpose and my energy was bound to be diluted. And if I'd had children, they would have come first. I have never been able to imagine my life when music did not come first, and my duty to a composer and what I was doing took so much, it took all of me. So thank God my husband was a very understanding man and realised that. You can't put children second, and I could not, in all conscience, resign myself to that dichotomy. So I chose my job. I don't have any regrets. I have lovely nieces and nephews and great nieces and nephews. But what you don't have, you don't miss. In that sense, I don't regret it.
There's one other question that intrigues me. As you stand at the threshold of your career, you come from working people and you're emerging from an age of great austerity, a world where every action had to be fit for purpose and nothing was ever wasted. What did you expect to bring with your voice? Was it entertainment? Was it spiritual communion? Or was it primarily the distractions from the privations of everyday life?
My destiny was with my voice. So then what do you do? You put it at the service of something. It is that I have put whatever voice I had at the complete service, I hope, of the composer and the poet. That was my aim in life, to do that to the utmost degree. And let the work that I did not just be memorised, or a role that I did just played. It had to get down to an awful lot of levels within me to satisfy my sense of purpose. That's the only way I can describe it. And it was a duty, but also, as I look back, the most privileged and wonderful way to spend one's life. I can't help but say at this stage how tremendously fortunate I feel to have been successful in using the outlet that I was given. See, luck.
In the knowledge that it's what you were made for.
I believe that, yes. I do believe that. I feel that I'm in the right slot, or have been in the right slot.
1959, you sang your first Handel, Rodelinda, as mezzo for Joan Sutherland's title role. Was she helpful? She hadn't quite made it yet. She was just about to yes. burst onto the scene
she
with
was
Lucia.
Indeed. But we were very aware as a cast that this was a very, very great lady. And of course, her destiny was an enormous one. I think we felt that very strongly even at that time. I could see also that she had difficulties coming to terms with memory, coming to terms with the business. And when you see people as gifted as that, and of course Richard Bonning helped her tremendously, she had a wonderful support as well, different from mine, very different, but there she was. I'm sure she would feel the same, felt the same way, and said so many times how much she owed him. You could see even at that stage that life wasn't easy for somebody like that. We're all such problematical people, you know, we really are, somehow we have to bear each other's burdens in a way because it's so hard.
And then the whole string of Handel operas, Tamerlano was next, Ariodante, Orlando, Admeto. Nowadays, we're used to them, but this was all completely new when you did it.
Yes, it was.
It was like discovering a continent.
Well, it was. And that was Anthony Lewis at the Barber Institute in Birmingham who gave me all those roles. And I started to use my voice in a way that was so much more diverse than the oratorio path I had been earning my living by. I still did opera. I've done opera every year of my working life, but it wasn't my raison d'être because, with the greatest respect, quite a lot of the mezzo roles are, well, they're not as fulfilling as a great deal of the concert work I had to do. And musically speaking, I always felt I have to sing the things that really stretch me, that really make me grow. And some of the repertoire works in the opera I knew were not my thing. So I concentrated really on the lesser known pieces, beginning with the Barber Institute and Anthony, Glyndebourne Chorus then, and of course Raymond Lepard. I've always had great good fortune both in the conductors I've worked with who've understood this way of thinking and also the directors I've worked with, particularly John Copley, who knows everything there is to know about opera and is one of the greatest teachers of us all. We all owe John Copley a tremendous debt because he approaches the dramatic in such a way that you go so deeply into the character. Everything happens with something like him. Other producers as well. I've loved to work with. Peter Hall brought something different. Again, not like John, but, you know, to work with people and conductors as I have, the names that occur to me now, again, I look at as the most extraordinary good fortune.
Anthony Lewis said of you, "You always arrived with the part fully memorised, putting the rest of the cast to shame."
Dear.
Your sense of duty was exceptional.
Well, that strictly speaking, can't be described as duty, learning the words and music, because I was always so petrified. I knew that if I went to a rehearsal without knowing exactly what I was doing, I'd be even more frightened. And at that stage, you're learning the moves, you're learning how the mechanics of the piece.
But they were petrified of you. Someone later on called you Dame Granite.
Yes, yes.
And they thought you were the acme, you were the monument, you were the model.
Well, I'm a very solid Yorkshire person, you see. It's part of the upbringing. But also the fact that how could I possibly step on a stage without knowing stuff backwards? I couldn't possibly do that because there's so much to learn at the last minute. And I thought, I've got to get this character into my bones. You don't do that in rehearsal. That's done in the months beforehand. So it wasn't the fact that I felt superior in any way or more knowledgeable. It's the fact that I was frightened to death to do anything else. I had to learn my work.
A request from Peter Pears to sing Purcell's Dido in Aldborough, 1962, brought you into the Benjamin Britten ambit. Was that daunting?